Okay, so the work I'd like to talk to you today, I suppose most closely connects to the type of approach that Jonathan spoke about earlier. Really using ideas from entanglement theory and the notion of quantum resource theories and trying to apply them to thermodynamics. And I suppose my job today is to perhaps identify areas in more traditional statistical mechanical approach which could find difficulties in quantum phenomena, and then argue for the resource theoretic perspective, and then present some results which try and get at features in thermodynamics which are intrinsically quantum mechanical and not just stochastic. Okay, so the broad trajectory is I'll first provide motivation and background, and then discuss possible limitations of more traditional approaches based on maybe partition functions or fluctuation theorems. I'll then recap briefly on resource theoretic formulations, and then talk about the role of symmetry principles within thermodynamics, before providing new results that try and encapsulate the role of quantum coherence in thermodynamics. And this is work with students and collaborators in London at Imperial and UCL. So Jonathan's here, also Terry Rudolph, and three PhD students. Okay, so really at the center of the game, perhaps, is the second law of thermodynamics, and there are many different formulations or statements thereof. And I suppose one particularly nice one, which isn't mentioned very often, is it's impossible to see inside a furnace solely by the light of the furnace. So they're very much about prohibitions, things you cannot do. So let me talk about more traditional approaches and formulations of this thermodynamic directionality and where it might encounter issues. So perhaps the simplest one is the notion that thermodynamics is only about the thermodynamic limit, except, well, it isn't, because nature already makes use of thermodynamic processes in highly non-macroscopic regimes. So for example, kinesins transporting along cytoskeleton. And so we'd like to describe non-asymptotic thermodynamics. And the reasons for this are motivated by progress, technological progress into micro and nanoscale systems. And also questions concerning whether coherence, for example, plays an active role in biology or not. And there are different opinions on this. And so what are the laws that operate at a micro and nano or beyond scales? How do coherent superpositions affect things? And how about more exotic things like entanglement? So if I were talking to a funding agency, I'd maybe mention about the applications and the large amounts of money devoted to nanotechnology. But the core question is a foundational one, that what are the foundational laws, the fundamental laws of thermodynamics? And ultimately, one would like to be able to describe highly entangled regimes of arbitrary scale. And so you might question whether more traditional approaches of thermodynamics based on expectation values or summing over microstates and forming partition functions is the right type of language to use. I mean, when we talk about entanglement theory, we don't write down partition functions, and we use a very, very different language. Okay, so, well, this traditional encapsulation of the second law basically says that places a bound on the amount of work you can get out in a particular thermodynamic process.
bounded by the decrease of the free energy. And it's highly applicable for systems such as steam engines and planes. However, you might say that, well, modern techniques are based around fluctuation theorems, which may provide a much finer and more powerful statement about this directionality. And so fluctuation theorems, such as those by Crookes and Jarzynski, apply to arbitrarily violent dynamics and are based on very minimal assumptions, such as initial Gibbsian states and time reversal invariance of the underlying Hamiltonian dynamics. They amount to a sharpening of the second law to an equality, or it can be viewed as a series of constraints on the moments of a distribution. And this is the Jarzynski equality, which in turn is a strictly stronger statement. But at the core of it is this kind of Crookes type equality, which the common theme is one of relating a forward trajectory to a backward trajectory. And the statement that there's a preferential direction and one trajectory is exponentially suppressed relative to another one. And so gamma star here is a time-reversed, sharp, microscopic trajectory.
Quick question. Is it important here that these things are trajectories, or it could be just abstract trajectory like spins, like nuclear spins evolving in time? So are we only talking about reversibility of the evolution, or there is something more about really space and momentum?
So abstractly, but it's not restricted just to, you know, space-time trajectories or phase-space trajectories, I should say. But I suppose maybe my next slide will maybe address what I mean by the classical obstacle. Because you can formulate what's called an exchange fluctuation theorem, which describes the exchange of heat between a bipartite quantum system. So you might have A and B, and they might be at different temperatures. And it's impossible to look at how the correlative structure of the state distorts the heat flow of that system. And if you do this, you find that a fluctuation theorem can be derived. However, the correlations that only play a role are in essentially classical correlations. And the reason for this is basically that the way in which fluctuation theorems are defined are based around measurements, and in particular, place strong constraints on the measurements in order for it to work within the framework of fluctuation theorems. And so you're invariably forced into classical regimes, and it's quite hard to break out of this. I'm not saying that it's impossible to. There is wiggle room, but the notion of making a disturbing measurement on your system means that, or it suggests the approach is poorly suited to things like coherence and entanglement. Okay, so how should we handle intrinsically quantum mechanical properties in thermodynamics? And even maybe what do I mean by thermodynamics at all? Well, I suppose I perhaps would distinguish three separate areas. Thermodynamics itself, and then statistical mechanical descriptions of it, but then also information theoretic aspects. And there are obviously links. So the traditional lineage of statistical mechanics providing an underlying explanation of phenomena such as entropy and heat and specific heats. But then there are connections to information theoretic aspects. And so one might want to explore or build on this. and perhaps something like a maximum entropy principle. How and so, although maximum entropy principles are highly attractive and powerful in notions, it's one could argue that the existing ones are perhaps too reliant on statistical mechanics, and perhaps actually our way of thinking about thermodynamics is biased too much by statistical mechanics in the first place. And perhaps one could look for a more direct connection between information theoretic approaches and thermodynamics itself, especially in the light of something like entanglement. OK, so really, the way I see kind of recent developments coming out of quantum information theory is really that they have a lineage going back to the 60s. And so there's this really lovely book by Robin Giles, which isn't that well known, on the mathematical foundations of thermodynamics. And the perspective is really that thermodynamics is about it's ultimately about what states you can or cannot access, subject to physical constraints. And it may be more reliable to base your starting points on something broad and abstract such as this, rather than notions such as temperature, heat, or concepts that may be inapplicable or can't be defined in extreme regimes. And so I think I prefer this as the notion of, or at least a start working notion of what thermodynamics should mean in extreme quantum regimes. Of course, one can compare this with entanglement theory. So our modern understanding of entanglement is really under the perspective of local operations and classical communications. And the accessibility or inaccessibility of one quantum state from another under that class of operations. And so by basing yourself on these kind of primitive notions, you can actually go a long way. And so, for example, in the thermodynamic setting, you could talk about a single unit of entropy. So using the structure of the transformations to define your quantities. And so ice at 0 Celsius going to water at 0 Celsius, so you can just call a single unit of entropy. In the same way as we can say this is a single unit of entanglement, which is a single state. There is no observable, which is entanglement. We use primitive units. And so you might consider a standard thermodynamic scenario. Perhaps you have a star lying around, and you put some ice cubes near it. But then, unfortunately, the star goes nova, highly non-equilibrium. But eventually, things settle down into some sort of thermodynamically well-defined state. And then you can say, well, you can count the number of ice cubes that you can melt and define the maximal number you can melt in going from these two configurations. And so by using the primitive unit as a yardstick, you can define measures such as entropy for arbitrary thermodynamic systems. And so the partial order, pre-order of the theory is really what's key. So you have maximally ordered states in some sense, and thermodynamic transformations evolve towards some maximally disordered states in some sense. And in a parallel way, the same thing happens for entanglement theory. We've got notions of maximally entangled states, local operations and classical communications, all the way down to zero entangled separable states. And you can build measures of entanglement which capture the amount of entanglement in the sense that the measures are monotones under the transformations. So if rho goes to sigma under the set of allowed operations, then the amount of entanglement can be no more in sigma than in row. And so an interesting question you can ask is, if you have some sort of thermodynamic ordering, when what type of orderings admit a unique entropic formulation? And what I mean by this is rho goes to sigma if and only if the entropy of rho is less than or equal to the entropy of sigma. And this was actually answered in quite a nice way in this work here by Lieb and Ingelsen. And the details aren't so important, but at the very least, it's good to emphasize certain components, in particular the three axioms that I've highlighted here. And you'll note in particular, what I've done is I've transcribed the axioms into a kind of quantum information or quantum formalism. And it's clear that this doesn't even make sense. And so there are regimes in which scale invariance or splitting of a system or a more subtle but extremely important comparability axiom will break down. And these are...
Yeah. So splitting is a really clone, something like that?
No. Yeah, in some sense, yeah, this is ill-defined, which is just the main point. But since these are, if it's an if and only of statements, it means you're forced into making a choice. You can say either thermodynamics is universal and you must consider and applicable to all regimes and you require more entropy functions, or it has a limited domain, and this defines the domain. Okay. So we'd like to build on these type of ideas, and learning from entanglement theory and resource theories is a good way. So really, at the core is kind of quantum resource theory recipe. And you define your free states, you define your free operations, and then this tells you, gives you a highly non-trivial ordering, tells you what resource states are, the useful states, and also how to measure these things. And so for entanglement theory, we have separable states, local operations, classical communications, and you say entanglement is non-increasing. So some very recent resource theory directions, which are interesting here by some people also at Perimeter. And I think there's a lot of kind of interesting ideas coming out of this. Mainly for me in relation to thermal operations. And this resource formulation of thermodynamics in terms of allowing your free states being thermal states and your free quantum operations being energy conserving operations, potentially involving a thermal bath. And so, analogous to the entanglement, you'd say some notion of athermality is non-increasing. Okay. And so, exactly as you can use entanglement resources to do non-trivial things, such as quantum teleportation, you can do non-trivial things with out of equilibrium states, such as raising a weight. Okay. So just before lunch, Jonathan talked about really conditions on the resource, the resource formulation of thermodynamics, and discussed these generalized free energy or set of second laws. And it's really a lovely result that you can encapsulate the ordering of states under quite a natural class of operations. And so it's you arrive at necessary and sufficient conditions for states which have zero coherence between energy eigen spaces. And so they're block diagonal in the energy eigen basis. And so this ordering of states does admit a clean and intuitive set of necessary and sufficient conditions given by these Rennie divergence type relations. And so these can be viewed as generalized free energies. So I won't talk much about that. Okay, so I suppose I would view this kind of necessary and sufficient conditions as being quasi-classical, quasi-classical in the sense that you can effectively diagonalize your states and really work with probability distributions. And at the core of it is a generalized form of majorization theory involving stochastic operations. But if you are interested in more intrinsically quantum mechanical aspects, then you need to worry about such things as quantum coherence, how it might affect thermodynamic processes. And so really at the heart of it, a useful thing to do is to go back and look at the first law of thermodynamics with a more careful eye. So the traditional form is really a statement about the conservation of energy. But really, it's a statement of a microscopic energy conservation globally. However, quantum mechanically, this is a statement about symmetries in your global quantum system. And so we know that symmetries are either represented by anti-unitary or unitary operators. And in this case, it's a unitary group. And you have this global constraint on this group action. And so the way I like to understand it is that the first law, as expressed in this commuting form, is placing a non-conservation constraint on two separate quantities. First is the system's energy, the amount of energy flowing in and out of the system. And secondly, the system's coherence. And the reason for this is because coherence between energy eigenbasis states transforms non-trivially under group action. And so the notion of a symmetry property of your state is really something important. And so one can look at the notion of symmetry, and in particular asymmetry, and ask abstract questions from an information theoretic perspective. And so I could say, which of these is most asymmetric? And intuitively have a notion that, well, this guy is the most asymmetric. He's not so bad, fairly symmetric in a rotational sense. But you'll note that this is an ordering of objects, and so it's again describing some sort of ordering of states from some preferred or well-defined way. And so in the same way as you can define a resource theory of entanglement and thermodynamics, it's also possible to define a theory of asymmetry, which was largely done by Rob Speckens and Iman Marvin, but also Gilad Gore and, I've done a little bit myself. So the way I like to maybe phrase it is, it's like a statement of a group theoretic statement of Anacreon and a principle. So all symmetric objects are alike. Each asymmetric object can be asymmetric in its own way. So in some sense, the symmetries are simple and easy to understand. It's the asymmetric objects which are non-trivial and hard. And so being theoreticians, when we look at a cow, we see something like this. But in reality, it's a much more complex object. And so how can you encapsulate this comparability or even incomparability, and how do you measure it? Well, again, it's a resource recipe in which you define a set of free states and a set of allowed operations. And so it's quite natural to allow the free states being symmetric states in the sense that the group structure leaves the state invariant for all group elements. And the free quantum operations are covariant operations in the sense that they commute with the ordering of the group action. And so this doesn't say that the operations leave the degree of asymmetry constant, because you can just take a quantum operation which destroys your system and creates a sphere. So you have that asymmetry is non-increasing. And again, you have maximally asymmetric states in some sense. It may not be a totally maximally asymmetric, but you have some notion of partial order down to symmetric states. So if you look at a rotational symmetry, then such rotationally invariant states include the singlet state or the maximally mixed state. But you have a whole array of asymmetric or pointy states schematically done here. How long do I have?
15 minutes.
And so in exactly the same way, you can use asymmetric objects to do otherwise impossible things. So I'll give some future advertisement, just because asymmetry theory is really, you're using group theory structure. I mean, you can do a lot of nice things to it. And so you can apply all the techniques of group theory and analyze asymmetry theory in terms of a virtual exchange of resource charges between subsystems. And so it lends itself to a very intuitive perspective in which resource states distribute their usefulness amongst a multipartite system. And if you focus on the resource state itself, it also has really nice structure in which instead of maybe the more traditional symmetry breaking, really what's happened is you get symmetry restoration in which the type of resource state you have can change both kind of topologically but also in terms of its measures. Okay, so I said that the first law of thermodynamics has this global group property associated to it. And so what I'm claiming is that the thermodynamics is a particular asymmetry theory, in fact, associated to the U1 phase symmetry. And the proof is, to show it is, it's extremely simple. Thermal operations are defined in this way, whereas covariant operations are defined in this way. However, there exists a covariance Dyspring dilation for all covariant operations, and this takes the same form as thermal operations. And so really, this is a particular instance of this covariant Dyspring dilation, and therefore thermal operations are a subset of this particular asymmetry theory. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I'll talk about some applications. So I've kind of advocated that the first law taken seriously suggests that one should look at coherence properties in terms of the resource theory of asymmetry. So what does that give you when you look at it? Well, I'll talk about these, and if you want more details, you can look at these papers. Well, the first claim is that free energies seem to be incomplete if you want to describe arbitrary thermodynamic ordering. And in particular, so this doesn't have to be restricted to the Reni free energies in particular, but if you give me any set of functions which behave like free energies in the following sense, that if rho goes to sigma, then these measures decrease. And also they behave like a distance in some sense, telling you how far from the Gibbs state you are. Then I'm claiming that this cannot provide a complete set of thermodynamic constraints. And the proof is actually very simple. In particular, I can just consider a qubit system with a Hamiltonian here, so that the incoherent states are the z-axis, so states with zero coherence in the energy eigenbases. Now, your free energies, say, get closer to the Gibbs state, so gamma is always the Gibbs state here, whereas the symmetry constraints say that asymmetry is non-increasing. So if I start here and consider a state sigma, it's allowed by the free energies, but it's forbidden by the symmetry constraint. And so it's basically as simple as that. Another aspect is the notion of work. So I don't view work as the central focus of thermodynamics, but it's clearly a very important one. And so in the same way as like the Zillard type engine, we can ask, is a qubit worth kT log 2? And again, I can allow quite a broad definition of work. So there's a lot of dispute about like what constitutes work and how it should be defined. But the basic notion should be a raising of a weight up a ladder through some height in some sense. And so I can allow you a notion of work which only depends on the moments of the Hamiltonian, perhaps the changes in the moments. If that's your notion of work, then it's quite easy to show that if you can get a quantity of work from a quantum state rho, then you can get exactly the same amount if you simply dephase the state in its energy eigenbasis. So this dephasing is the group averaging over the kind of twirling of the state over arbitrary evolution. And so there's a sense that the symmetry constraint means that ultimately work is locked in the coherences in a particular way. And this is a non-classical aspect. And so you can take an extreme example. If this is your Gibbs state, well, you can have a coherified version, which is fully pure. However, it decoheres exactly to the Gibbs state. And therefore, the theorem states that no work can be extracted from this pure qubit state on its own, with an emphasis on its own. In order to get non-trivial work out, you need to use additional resources, in particular coherent resources. However, if you're using coherent resources, you then have the question, because quantum mechanically coherence is a useful thing, how are you using those coherent resources, and are you doing your accounting correctly? I mean, a comparison could be made with the memory of a Maxwell daemon. If you don't account for the daemon's memory, you can apparently break the second law. And so it requires a very non-trivial resource counting. So it's interesting that a single copy, you can get zero work out, but if you have two copies, then automatically there's a relational coherence that's protected, and you can get non-zero amount. And it's kind of funny that for a degenerate Hamiltonian, two copies gives you kT log 2. And so one can look at the resource accounting in more detail and try and see if you can get, you can use a coherent state and get non-trivial workout from its coherent property. And so in some work which should be in the archive in the next couple of weeks with Jonathan and Matteo and Camille, we argue that it's only in a particular classical regime that you can ascribe the free energy to every qubit state. So I'll just briefly say that you can perturb the resource theory. You can see how it breaks or how it changes if you add in or allow extra things. So if you take the full resource theory and just allow as much energy as you want, right? So you can raise anything you want. You don't trivialize the theory entirely. You only expand to a subset of the transformations. So if you have a qubit state here, thermodynamically, the red curved area is the thermodynamically accessible states. But if you allow arbitrary amounts of work, you can only expand to the blue region. And so there's a lot of non-trivial structure here. So really, if I gave you as much energy as you wanted, it trivialized to arbitrary transformations, then that would be consistent potentially with energy or work being the only quantum resource of relevance. Right? But this at least argues that there's more to thermodynamics than just energy ordering, but coherence should play a role as well. It's possible to use this kind of group structure to place upper and lower bounds on generic coherence transformations. I'll just say that the basic approach is to apply harmonic analysis, and you can decompose all your objects into harmonic modes. But maybe I won't talk much about this. I'll finish with maybe the more broad and pressing question is like to determine the full thermodynamic ordering of states. So going arbitrary quantum states going to arbitrary quantum states and whether there's an entropic formulation. And so the previous components suggest that perhaps thermodynamics should be viewed in terms of looking at ordered energy and also coherent properties. So Jonathan talked about the work required to form a state and also the work you can get out of a state. And it's given by these Renyi divergence quantities. But you can also ask how much of so for more general quantum states with coherence, how much coherence is required to arrive at the state and how much coherence can be distilled out. And so it's possible to develop measures for these degrees of coherence. And so you might argue that you need to constrain two independent degrees of freedom, the coherent properties, which tell you how much coherence a state has, must have a thermodynamic ordering, which decreases, but also the free energy component, which tells you how you approach the Gibbs state. And so with the two previous notions, it's possible to arrive at least necessary entropic constraints. It's not known whether they're necessary and sufficient. But in addition to the free energy conditions which are necessary and sufficient for states with zero coherence in the energy eigenbasis, you can develop measures that are intrinsically aimed at the coherence in the state, which are asymmetry monotones, and measure how much the state deviates from its incoherent twin. And this combines nicely with the free energies that Jonathan talked about before, and also the alpha equals one traditional free energy, which we can now show that can be written, decomposed into an incoherent component and a coherent component, and that these must separately decrease. Well, it's also important to check you can get back to the macroscopic limit. And so it's actually quite straightforward to show that in the asymptotic IID case, everything collapses down to the traditional formulation. And so whatever arbitrary extreme regime you have, if you have enough scaling up, you recover more familiar results. So to review, in the macroscopic, highly classical, low correlation regime, there's an essentially unique entropy function which determines the ordering of states. When you go to micro, nanos, and nanoscales, where zero coherence or very little between energy eigenbases, then fluctuation type results don't capture everything, and it seems you need to look at more generalized free energies. And then finally, in the presence of coherence, well, we have developed additional constraints, but it's unclear whether they're necessary and sufficient. And so going forward, it would be nice to make more contact with actual known physics, such as in particular ones where coherence is known to play an active role, maybe transport properties or conductance. But also more information theoretic questions, such as feedback control. And there have been nice experiments in that regard. And maybe the bigger question of whether the entropic conditions are both necessary and sufficient, and if they're incomplete, what new notions we need. Okay, thank you.
Are there any questions?
I have this mostly curiosity. I was kind of, I like it very much that you presented the lib and inverts on axioms in a language that we can actually more easily capture. I was still kind of intrigued by the splitting property. So the one that is, that doesn't really make too much sense when we write it in so, our language. So what situation did the lib and inverts on have in mind when they pose this action? Typically one has a model in mind.
So it really relates to a system where you can divide it arbitrarily finely or scale it up.
So it's kind of infinite IID limit. Yeah? You have a lot of tensor to the infinite. And then
well, they're thinking very much physically. So some system which you can really keep. So for example, they emphasize that it's strictly inapplicable to something like cosmological systems, because in some cases, if you scale them up, well, things could go a little awry.
So it was mostly a question of scale. So this T would be some parameter of the state. So you have to parameterize the family of state.
Yes, so it's more the quantity of a particular substance you have. Mm-hmm. So water you have, you know, 10 kilograms or 1 gram. So there's a nice paper which by the group in ETH, which expresses the Lieb-Ingertsen results for quantum information frameworks and for these kind of block diagonal scenarios in which you work in terms of the probability distributions and translate. So in particular for that, they need to extend the notion of scaling. So it's a mathematical, if I remember correctly, it's a mathematical construction which is consistent for that integer number of copies of the state, but you extend it out.
So it's a sort of IID.
Yeah.
Thanks.
More questions? So let me actually ask a question. The A alphas that you have. So if the F alphas and the A alphas go down both, then you know that you can do the transformation. What about the converse? Is it clear that the converse must fail, or is it open?
Whether it's no, it's not. It's not open.
It's
not known.
So there's no counterexample. Something's possible, even though.
No. At least none that I know.
actually one more. So the A alphas on many copies, the rate goes to zero. That's what you showed. What if you have, say, a many body system, which is not product form? Does it also go to zero?
Yeah. So this is quite an interesting question, actually. So I've wondered whether, for example, it's possible to construct a kind of macroscopic limit in which the Reni free energies go to the standard free energy, but the asymmetry, the kind of coherence measures tend to something non-trivial. So some sort of either a superconductor type scenario, like, you know, something which macroscopic coherence. It's not obvious, but it's something which will be interesting.
More questions? No more questions? Then let's thank David again.